The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Great to see you. Today's topic, well, I should say, first of all, if you've heard me speak on this topic before, I know I'm repeating some of these stories. And I hope if you heard them many times before, you won't think of them as like the same old boring stories, but think of it more as having breakfast with some old friends, perhaps. So indulge me. Today's topic is money. And of course, we all know that money can't buy happiness. And so I mentioned before, I was watching Oprah Winfrey one day. I can't remember why, but I know there was a good reason. And Oprah was interviewing Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was in the days before he was the governor of California. Arnold was there with his wife, Maria Shriver. And Oprah was fawning all over him about how famous he'd been, etc., and his movies, and then how much money he'd made. And Arnold looked at her and said, "Oprah, I have to tell you, I have found money does not bring happiness." "Oh, really, Arnold? Why is that?" "Well, I now have $50 million, and I am no happier than when I had $48 million. And he laughs at the idea as well. Spike Milligan, "All I ask is a chance to prove that money can't make me happy." And so, yeah. And as a society, we're fascinated by the super rich. So the Australian Financial Review this year, in the Australian magazine, the rich 250, that would be Richard Pratt, Forbes magazine, the 50 richest Australians. Gina Reinhart was number one that particular month. I think it depends on how the iron ore price goes. But to talk about money and possessions is very sensitive. Generally, as a pastor of a church involved in Christian ministry, I talk with people, mainly businessmen, often about all sorts of personal things. And I might talk about someone's marriage, their children, even their sex life. But there's one question that's never on the table, and that is, how much money do you make? You don't ask that. That would be very awkward. Why? Because money and what we own is all tied up with our value, our status, how we see ourselves. Alain de Botton, an English writer, actually he says he's an atheist, but his diagnosis of the anxiety we feel about our status and how it's linked to how much money we have is brilliant. If you haven't read Status Anxiety, I could recommend it. The first half of it in diagnosing the problem that we feel, you can call it status, love, acceptance, but the problem we feel, he diagnoses the problem brilliantly. I don't think he has as many answers in the second half, but it's a clever book. Question today is, can we make money and possessions the meaning and purpose of life? Can that be the thing that will actually fill the hole in our soul, that will give us the meaning and purpose that we need? Does it carry the weight that we put on it? The book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament addresses that. Let me give you an introduction. If you haven't been here the last couple of weeks, let me get you up to speed. In your handout is some of the passages, some of the parts of this little book of Ecclesiastes. And the entire book is printed out in those little booklets with the houses, the housing subdivisions on the front. Feel free to take one of those if you'd like. But let me look at the introduction to the whole book and we'll get up to speed. Chapter 1, verse 1, "The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem." A book that's written either by King Solomon, about 950 BC he lived, or through the eyes of Solomon. And Solomon was the patron of the wisdom literature in the Old Testament. He says in verse 2, "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher, "utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless." Now, there's a problem with this little book, and that is it's very hard to translate that Hebrew word, the one that's down there translated as meaningless. It's hard to get an exact translation into English. The Hebrew word hevel, or havel, means a mist or a vapor, something that's transient, something that's ephemeral. The idea of, you know, you breathe out on a cold morning and your breath is there, I see it, and then it's gone. It's that feeling. So it doesn't mean necessarily that something's bad, it's just saying it doesn't last. That's his point. And he's saying it feels like nothing actually lasts. That's the way the world feels. And so he asks a question, chapter 1, verse 3. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? The word gain is a commercial term. We might say, what's the bottom line? What's the cash value? What's left? And labour can cover physical or mental work. So if you work with a hammer or a mouse, it covers that. At the end of the day, you're tired. And the little phrase, under the sun, very important in understanding the book. 29 times in just 12 short chapters. What does he mean? I think what he means is this. If you just look out at the world, what do you see? If you're just armed with your eyes open and common sense, what does the world look like? And it's as if, he said, if God hadn't spoken to us, if we didn't have the rest of the Bible, if we didn't have revelation from God, how would you make sense of the world? What would you see? Now, he's not an atheist. He knows that God is there. But if God hadn't spoken to us, what's the nature of the world that we see? And so he sets out on a quest to find what it is that actually lasts. What is it that's not Hebel, that's not meaningless? Last week he looked at the idea of wisdom and pleasure and found, yeah, that's good, yeah, and fun, but it doesn't ultimately last. It won't carry the weight that hedonism puts on it. Today, money and possessions. Now, in the book, and I hope I might motivate you to read this, it's only 10 pages in my Bible. In this little book, he talks about money in a number of different places. Chapter 5 is kind of a general view of the world and money and possessions and the way people respond to them. And chapter 2 is about his personal angst in achieving so much and building so much wealth and then what will happen to it. So I thought what I'd do is very quickly take you through 5 problems in chapter 5. I'll walk you through them. It's so easy to explain and illustrate and give examples. I just won't be able to do that. I won't have time. But you'll get the idea. Now, here's the irony. I think you'll understand the points very quickly. The question is whether or not you agree with them or whether or not you share the same worldview. But we'll come to that. All right. Problem number one. If you see on the sheet there or on the screen, chapter 5, verse 10, he says, whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. This too is meaningless. There was an article in the Atlantic magazine last year entitled The Reason Many Ultra-Rich People Aren't Satisfied with Their Wealth. And it reported on the research of this man, Michael Norton, from the Harvard Business School. He said this, at a certain level of wealth, the next million isn't going to suddenly revolutionise your lifestyle. What drives people, once they've reached that point of millions and millions, to keep pursuing more? Norton says this. His research regularly points to 2 central questions that people ask themselves when determining whether they're satisfied with something in their life. The 2 questions are these. Am I doing better than I was before? And am I doing better than other people? This applies to wealth, but also to attractiveness, height, other things that people fret about. He says, this instinct to measure and compare doesn't disappear once people have an obscene amount of money. The problem is, am I doing better than I was, is only pushing people in one direction, that is, up. And if a family amasses, say, $50 million, but upgrades to a neighbourhood where everyone has money, more, they feel a lot less rich than they did before when their peers had much less money. And so the goalposts keep shifting. Which is why, if you love money, it's never ultimately enough. Now, here's what's happened in the industrialised world in the last, forgive the broad brush, but in the last, say, 150 years. There's, I don't know if you can see, but you can see the way the graphs go. That is GDP per capita in real US dollars, in real 2011 dollars, and it moves from 1860 through to 2020, so about 160 years. And what you'll see, especially if you're listening on the recording, let me explain it, there's 13 industrialised countries. They basically all move in a similar line, and that is they move from around about $1,000 per person per annum in 1860, with a geometric massive increase after World War II, through to around about $25,000 to $30,000 US by 2020. Now, what's that? That's a 25-fold increase in real income per person from around the world. In these 13 industrialised countries. And not only that, Australia is one of the world's wealthiest nations. Any number of reports, there's one from Credit Suisse, but I won't stay to dwell on that. So here's the question. Why does it always feel like we're trying to keep warm with a bunny rug? Why is it that it's never either we've got cold feet or cold shoulders? Why is it there's never quite enough? Now, here's the answer. A rising tide lifts all the boats, but everyone still feels like they're at sea level. Yeah? Okay. A rising tide is... Now, I don't want to boast, but I think it's okay. At home, Kathy and I have a machine. It's like a big white box, about that high and about that wide. And it's like you open the door, it's under the sink, and we have a sink with hot and cold running water. No, really, we do. Hot and cold running water. And you pull the door out, and then there's a rack that slides out, and then you take the dirty dishes and you put them into the rack, okay, and put all the dirty dishes in there, and then your wife comes and restacks them. But and then you close the door and push a button, and it washes the dishes. You come back a while later, and they're all clean. Really? Amazing, yeah. Now, I tell my kids, when I grew up in Grafton in the bush 50 years ago, there were two dishwashers in our family. That was me and my brother. And it was automatic. My dad said, you'll do the dishes every night. That just happened. So at home, we have a colour television. True. And it's like, it's about that big. And the picture is amazing. In 1992, a friend of mine who was a doctor gave me his second-hand mobile phone. Now, it was the size and weight of a paving brick, and it had buttons about the size of postage stamps, but it was so cool. And I used to carry a briefcase around. All I had in it was the mobile phone, but that was the only way to carry it. It was great. Now, do you know what? I've got my own mobile phone now, and look how small it is. And I can pick up I can dial all sorts of people all over the world. It's amazing. And none of you have been bowled over by any of that. I guarantee no one walked into a house last week and said, "Wow, dishwasher, amazing," or a mobile phone. Yesterday's luxuries become today's necessities, become invisible tomorrow, and we just get richer and richer and richer, and we do not notice it because everybody's at sea level. Just the way the world is. Or number two, as goods increase, chapter 5, verse 11, as goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owners except to feast their eyes on them? An old story, please forgive me. What can you do but look at it? My brother worked in a business a while ago. His partner owned a house on the Lower North Shore in Sydney. I remember my brother speaking to my father and saying, and Dad, my partner bought quite a big house. It's just him and his wife. And he's a builder, and he knocked the roof off, and he put a first story on it. And then he took all the bedrooms and moved them upstairs, and downstairs he's got this huge lounge room. It's amazing. And we went to visit him, and we counted 16 lounge chairs. He's got 16 lounge chairs in his lounge. And my dad said, 16 lounge chairs, eh? I bet he's only got one bum. And that's what can you do but look at them. Or Marie Kondo, the life-changing magic of tidying up. She sold 10 million copies of that. She's got a Netflix program. Why? We just got so much stuff, we're drowning in it. Or New York Times bestseller, Stuffocation. James Wallman got all these stats about how much, basically, we're drowning because of the stuff that we've got. And we go to problem three. The sleep of a labourer is sweet, whether they eat little or much, but as for the rich, their abundance permits them no sleep. Well, I haven't got to tell this room that stress and worry about finances and money, etc., keeps people awake. Or problem number four, I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when they have children, there is nothing left for them to inherit. Well, I know some in the room here work in estates, etc., and what do you see all the time? Ugly fights over wills. I never thought it would happen in my family, but it's happened. The old cliche, where there's a will, there's a relative, is absolutely right. Or there's fights about who controls the family business or who controls the different trusts, etc. I don't have time, but if you want to see about the idea of money being lost and nothing to inherit, just Google billionaires who lost it all and the lists come up. And number five, let me pause. Business Review Weekly used to publish the Rich 200 list. I don't think they do it anymore. This is the 2009 edition. What they used to do, they would, in the front of the magazine, they would list how much money the richest 200 owned. So in this particular year, Anthony Pratt and his family on $4.3 billion, 2009. And then they'd list that down to the 200s, and that was a fairly paltry 160 million. So a huge difference in those 200. In the back, they would list departures. People who had either had a bad year on the stock market, or sadly, sometimes it was people who had died. And there'd be a brief obituary, and then at the end of it, they would list how much they left behind. And here's what I was surprised about. In the front of the book, those who were on the list, huge variation in the amount that they were worth. But when it came to the obituaries and how much they left behind, the amount was always the same. And the answer? Everything. They left everything. You see problem number 5, verse 15? Everyone comes naked from their mother's womb, and as everyone comes, so they depart, for they take nothing from their toil that they can carry in their hands. This too is a grievous evil. As everyone comes, so they depart. And what do they gain since they toil for the wind, as all their days they eat in darkness and great frustration, affliction and anger? If money and possessions are the centre of your life, of course it's frustrating that you'll leave it all behind. Well, have a look. I've got the quote there from chapter 2, verse 18, where it's much more personal for Solomon. He says this, chapter 2, verse 18. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish, yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. You work so hard and then the person you leave it to may well be an idiot. I can't help but think as Solomon wrote these words, he probably looked out the window and saw his son, Rehoboam. How could I put it? Rehoboam was a complete muppet. Solomon built an amazing empire, administratively brilliant, accumulated huge amounts of wealth, organized the whole country. Rehoboam destroyed the throne, lost 10 out of the 12 tribes to Solomon's family, set up the seeds for civil war, and managed to achieve that in 4 days. I'm sure Solomon shook his head. Or see 2 verse 20. So my heart began to despair over all the toilsome labour under the sun. Verse 21. For a person may labour with wisdom and knowledge and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. There was an article in the Monthly magazine last year, The Endless Reign of Rupert Murdoch. And basically the article says News Corp is run on the assumption that Rupert will never die. He wouldn't allow for a 10-year or 20-year succession plan. He finally approved a 30-year succession plan when he was 76 years old. Rupert will never die. I guess that's the case. So there's the five. If we love money, we'll always want more. As we own more and more, we can only look at it. Riches can bring stress and worry or overindulgence. Riches can damage those who hold them and can disappear. And we'll leave it all behind and give it to someone else who hasn't worked for it. There you go. Now, two alternatives. One of them is in the book of Ecclesiastes. Alternative or an answer. Under the sun? Well, I think what Solomon says is he looks under the sun. Instead of trying to own the world, can we simply work at enjoying it? Instead of wanting to own the world, can we work at actually enjoying things, not as the meaning of life, but as a gift of God? You see 5 verse 18, the very next thing he says? this is what I observed to be good, that it's appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of life God has given them, for this is their lot. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions, and notice he says the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and to be happy in their toil, this is the gift of God. They seldom reflect on the days of their life because God keeps them occupied with gladness of heart. It's a little bit hard to know exactly what verse 20 means, but I think what he means, if God lets you able to enjoy life and enjoy the things he's given you, you won't be all wound up with existential angst. You'll actually just relax and enjoy things. There is a difference, isn't there, between constantly being driven to want more and more and more to compete with peers that keep changing versus being able to just enjoy what we've got. Hey, I've got a dishwasher. How cool is that? Look at how great the football looks on that television. That's fantastic. I got a mobile phone. That's great. I live in a city where the trains pretty much run on time. The streets are clean. With a little square, with a little rectangular piece of plastic, I can walk into a cafe, wave it around, and someone gives me a great coffee or bacon and eggs. How good is that? And when I walk past the yachts at Walsh Bay or Rose Bay or wherever it is, yeah, I haven't got a yacht, but I've got the harbour and I've got the sunshine, and I don't have to worry about the yacht on the other 360 days a year that I wouldn't use it. And you see verse 19, what he's saying is, if you can be happy in your work, if you can actually enjoy your work, it's a gift of God. So that's the first alternative. Can you just enjoy things rather than having to own the world? Now, the second answer or alternative, you may think, and I understand it quite possibly, you may think, well, look, sure, money isn't the meaning of life and it's not everything, but hey, it's a long way ahead of whatever comes second. Right? It's a long way ahead of whatever comes second. Let me just move us, though, out of Ecclesiastes and into the rest of what the Bible says, because we don't live just under the sun. God has spoken to us, and particularly in the person of Jesus. And Jesus teaches about money. I think it'd be in the top two or three things that he ever speaks about, more than almost anything else, money. He doesn't say money or possessions are bad. He just says they're seductive. They're seductive. They keep drawing us away to think that's the meaning of life. So you've got the five problems out of Ecclesiastes, and there they all are, and they're not hard to understand. But do we agree? Now, let me show you something that Jesus teaches in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5 through to 7, Jesus teaching to the crowds. And in chapter 6, he speaks about possessions, money, and what we treasure. I'll show you something from verse 22. Chapter 6, verse 22, he says this: "The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" Now, what's he talking about? I'm reminded of the fact that I've spent 250 hours teaching kids how to drive. I added it up. I worked with three daughters and a son, 250 hours. One of the first things you teach your kids when they get in the car is this: if you're ever going to change lanes or move to the right, you've got to turn your head and look behind you. Why? Because another car can be right there beside you and you will not see it in your mirrors. Reason? There's a blind spot right beside you. You need to be aware of that. That's what Jesus is saying in this verse about the eyes and darkness. In the context of treasure, that is, sometimes your eyes just cannot see what the problem is. Sometimes your eyes are dark or don't work. What's he mean? Greed is our great blind spot. 30-something years I've been doing this and talking to people. No one has ever come to me and said, "Al, I want to talk to you. I've got a real problem with greed." No one. No one. Why? Because it's the blind spot. Right? Now, it's our society's blind spot. That's why we get richer and richer and richer, and we always say it's never enough. Now, let me go back. Jesus gives a totally different view on what we should value. That's verse 22. Let me take you back just to the paragraph before, as he talks about two treasures, and then two eyes, and then two lords. Here we go. He says this: "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. Shane, the stuff that we own here, it's not that it's bad, but it doesn't last. It rusts, it wears out, it can be stolen. It's a bit like Ecclesiastes says, it's a mist. What's the alternative? He says, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now, he's not just talking about act now in a certain way so that in the future, in heaven, everything will be great. That's true. But he's talking about now, about knowing God and valuing that and investing in knowing God, and that's a treasure that will never be taken from you. It's that is where true riches are. Why does it matter? You see verse 21, it's what we treasure will own our hearts. What we value, what we love will ultimately own us. Then he says, well, can you see that? And that's where the thing about the two eyes is the very next thing that he says. And then he talks about, well, two treasures, two eyes, and then two masters or lords. Verse 24, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. You see the word there, masters, Greek word kurios, being translated master or lord. He doesn't say, don't try and serve two masters or two lords. He says, you can't do it. You either serve God or you serve money or possessions. Now, how can you tell? How do we tell who our master is? Very quickly, our master was the one we serve. Our master sets our values. Our master gives us our status. If money and possessions is our master, well, that'll get all our time and energy. There'll be an endless chase for more and more and more, and you know what? We'll never be satisfied. If money sets our values, we'll end up putting possessions ahead of people or things ahead of relationships. And in the end, if money gives us our status, our value as a person, we'll spend our life looking sideways. If Jesus is our master, our focus will be actually on knowing him, serving him, and serving and knowing others. If Jesus sets our values, do you know what? We'll actually be able to be satisfied and be generous. And our status will come from actually belonging to him rather than always looking sideways. How can you tell? Here's the acid test. The way to know whether money is your master or not, the question is this: can you give money away? Now, I don't mean give $5 to the homeless guy. That's good, you should do that. But I mean a number of zeros. Well, with a number at the front always helps. Okay. Can you give money away? Because you'll give to what you truly love. Can you do that? And Jesus says to be generous to those who are poor, to those who need a hand, to be able to invest in people hearing about him and coming to know Jesus as well. And if you don't get it, if you say, oh, look, I just, you could pray and you could ask God to open your eyes so you do see this clearly. And to finish, Jesus doesn't say this to spoil our fun. Jesus doesn't say this to say, oh, I'm going to stop those guys and those people having all of this nice stuff. No. Jesus says this so we won't invest our lives in something that ultimately won't last and won't hold the weight that we put on it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as usual, some very good questions. Did Old Testament Judaism have any idea of taking a step back and reflecting, or were they something to just keep on working to make gains and more or less to justify existence? There's a whole series of strands in the Old Testament that would be relevant to that. In the Old Testament, the blessing of God was seen often in a material way. So God promised, for example, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob and others that he would bless them. And the sign of that was that they were wealthy, prosperous, etc. By the time you get to the New Testament, that's just a symbol, if you like, of the coming spiritual blessings of truly knowing God and the promise of forgiveness, etc. So you move to spiritual blessings in the New Testament. The problem in Judaism is exactly the problem we have, and that is that greed took over. So at the moment, in my personal Bible reading, I've decided I'll read through all the minor prophets. That's a little prophet, the little prophetic books at the end of the New Testament. And again and again and again, they are banging the drum of God saying, you are exploiting the poor, you are driven by greed, you're crushing the needy, etc. And so that was all done in the aim of getting richer and richer. And so they suffered from similar problems. And the other problem they had is, as the nation of Israel got wealthier and wealthier, guess what happened? They walked away from God. Okay. And one of the other great things that took them away from the God of the Bible who brought them out of slavery was the promise of the prosperity religions around them. So Baalism and the Canaanite religions were all about you worship Baal or whoever and he'll make your crops grow and give you lots of cattle and he'll make you rich. So it's just a good thing that there's no hint of that around now in religion where people are saying, you know, God wants you to be rich and all that sort of thing. Glad that's totally died out. Question two, was there a proper system of tithing enforced at this time or was it your option to donate money? Deuteronomy chapter 14 gives the laws about tithing in the Old Testament. That is that the Israelites were to give 10% of their income each year to God. One in 3 years, that money, sorry for the, some of the details are a little bit fine, but one in 3 years, that tithe was to be taken centrally to the temple, etc., and used to feed the Levites who didn't have land to work, and also as social security for widows, orphans, and those who needed help. So there was a social security system set up using the tithe. Here's the other amazing thing. On the other years, they would use that 10% to have a massive party. And they were to take their tithe, and God said, it's too hard to carry all of the cattle or grain or whatever, turn it into money, go to the place that I will choose and celebrate the goodness of God with 10% of your income for the year. Now, I don't know what you earn in a year, but I reckon you have a pretty good party on that. So that was tithing, and it wasn't optional, it was compulsory. It needed to be the social security system. Is our work a form of idolatry, i.e. not just money, work itself? It can be. If work becomes the centre and meaning of our life, it can take the place of God. I think in the end you'll end up worshipping whatever gives you status and whatever gives you security. And that can be work, that can be money, that can be body image, any of those things. I think the book of Ecclesiastes is trying to say those things aren't bad, they just won't carry the weight that we put on them. And ultimately they'll let us down. If work becomes your God, you need to get yourself ready for relevance deficit syndrome. It's coming. There'll come a time when the phone doesn't ring and you're looking for emails. Why does wealth lead mostly to virtue signalling? Is it a guilt phenomena? I don't think it's guilt. I think it's the idea of us wanting to be loved by the world. Alain de Botton's book, Status Anxiety, his first half of that, where are we? I didn't have time to read it out. The first half of that book is brilliant in diagnosing the problem. That is, we want love or we want respect, etc. And that's what, if you put that in simply into economics, the more money you've got, generally the more respect and love you get. And it's true. I know, if I dress up in the suit and tie and go to the shop, I get treated differently to if I'm just dressed kind of, you know, sloppy and casual. Even at a trivial level like that, you notice it. So is it virtue signalling? No, I think it's the pursuit of status. What you do with your money can also be virtue signalling, which is interesting. It's why Jesus says if you're going to give, give anonymously. Then you're giving for the right reasons. And there's a... I can't understand the mathematical symbols. If you wrote it, you better come and explain it to me. To what extent is the pursuit of wealth legitimate to protect for retirement and our kids' inheritance, etc.? Yes, there's the Bible assumes that we will work. The Bible assumes that you can save. The Bible assumes economic and financial responsibility. But there's a line where you cross where that actually becomes the meaning and purpose of life. And I think the test of that, if you're looking for the test of that, is the ability to be generous to other people and to what you give to. And I think it was Gloria Steinem, the feminist writer, said, you can tell our values by the stubs of our checks. Right? Let me update it. You can tell our values by our credit card statements when you look. So what you do with your money will show what you love and who you actually serve. But it's not wrong to prepare for retirement and not wrong for kids to get an inheritance.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.